evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayen Deng Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Friday, July 27th, 2018. South Sudanese youth learn some valuable lessons from Rwandans.
Somebody came up openly and said in our face that I have killed the family members of these people. It takes courage for someone to come up and openly tell this.
And some South Sudanese say they're not happy about the new power-sharing deal.
We see that the boundaries will not be clear and also the referendum could not go ahead because there will be no security in South Sudan as usual.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A group of South Sudanese youth is visiting Rwanda to learn from Rwanda's post-conflict success story. The youth say they found that sustainable peace, reconciliation, and a concerted effort to heal the wounds of the past will help South Sudan become a better place after years of war. Magume Davis Wakarinj has this report for VOA from Kigali, Rwanda.
The group visited Rwanda genocide memorial sites and talked to genocide survivors and the perpetrators of human rights abuses. Hakim Monyukwil Awok, who works with the local NGO Empower Kids South Sudan, was among a dozen youth who visited Rwanda this week.
If Rwandans can forgive themselves, why can't we do it? For example, when we were in its reconciliation village, someone came up openly and said in our face that I have killed the family members of these people. It takes courage for someone to come up and openly tell this. It also takes courage for somebody whose parent or relative is killed to forgive. This is a good spirit that South Sudan will take. That's something very crucial that we have taken.
In 1994, Hutu-led government and ethnic militias killed more than 800,000 Tutsis and murdered Hutus in a period of 100 days. South Sudan's conflict has claimed the lives of tens of thousands of people since it began in late 2013, according to the National Crisis Group. More than 4 million people have been displaced from their homes, with at least 2 million seeking refuge in neighboring countries. The initial conflict erupted over a power struggle between President Salva Kiir and his former deputy, Riek Machar. Fighting quickly spread across the country, taking on ethnic undertones. Another youth, Elizabeth Dingluol, says she learned in Rwanda that South Sudanese from various ethnic groups should look at one another as equal citizens if the country is ever going to move forward.
What I have learned a lot is the privilege that, you know, people from different communities, which is so hard for us when we are back at home, be it in Kakuma refugee camps or even in South Sudan itself, it's so hard for different communities to come together and, you know, and discuss on issues that are going to bring peace, and the cohesion and the understanding on the way we were acting as one country, not being defined by which tribe we are coming from.
Youth Deng Gaigat Ruak says it is all about opening up to each other.
What I've learned from here, given the testimonies of the victims of the Rwanda genocide, I really felt that there's no need for people to kill themselves. We must talk and iron out what is causing us the suffering in our country.
More than two decades after the 1994 genocide, Rwanda is seen as an example of socioeconomic growth and development. Natasha Uwimanzi is the development coordinator for the Aegis Trust, a British NGO which campaigns to prevent genocide worldwide. Women says she believes these young people will spread the message of hope and forgiveness when they return to South Sudan.
The positive values that we impacted on them during the peace education, like compassion and forgiveness and empathy, into their own personal lives, and they start to put them into practice. Where if someone has wronged them, then they forgive. And if they've wronged someone, then they have the courage to ask for forgiveness.
Women says it is important to utilize that message with wives, husbands, sisters, brothers and children in order to move from the dark past and envision a bright future. She says it is particularly important to engage the youth because they are the ones who are most often manipulated by politicians to commit atrocities. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinj in Kigali, Rwanda.
Jonglei state officials have banned some songs they say incite hatred and violence between different ethnic communities. Jonglei state deputy governor Agot Alier says he has directed security organizations to arrest anyone found singing or playing such songs as a form of entertainment. He says some of the songs are being circulated on social media. Dengai Deng has the details for VOA from Bor.
Jonglei State Deputy Governor Alier says unidentified individuals in the community have composed songs that encourage violence. As a result, the Jonglei State Council of Ministers decided on Tuesday to ban all songs that incite hatred or violence during traditional dances or any other sort of entertainment.
The incitement of conflicts and violence within the communities, I think there remain there to be rejected and at the same time condemned by us, first of all, as a community, be they elders, be they the youth, women and all these type of groups in the community. They condemn these things, they reject them, they don't want them. Again, we as a government, I think we said we deliberate on it and we'll issue out some of the orders pertaining to this issue to try to curb the things, okay?
Alier says security operatives are on the lookout for anyone violating the new ban and will arrest any person found singing or playing a divisive song for entertainment.
Those who have either by local areas, be they studios, yeah, like they hear at times have the things in the market, there are sons and daughters of these areas, okay? Values that are immoral, that are bound to push community toward conflicts, should not even be issues of entertainment. Huh? Unless somebody wants to tell us that he or she is not responsible, we will outlaw anybody that is trying to play them around in his or in her place. And those people may face the court of law.
The deputy governor says South Sudanese should focus on the ongoing peace process instead of getting involved in activities that create divisions.
We are all aware about some of the challenges that are facing us, be they in the area of security, be they in the area of economics, livelihood of the people. So we'll have to be focusing on that and hoping that the peace agreement will be signed. Things will revert back to normality.
Bor Town resident Joseph Achek says he is disappointed to see some people circulating songs on social media that incite some communities against others.
I really don't appreciate the practice being carried on by the youth and the artists who produces the song. And I would urge the authority concerned to at least take some measures in order to stop the practice being carried on, because it is a source of conflict and it is a kind of division between ourselves, which is not our key objectives. As South Sudanese, we should be one and we remain one.
Achek is calling on authorities to control the use of social media in order to stop the circulation of songs that incite hatred.
It's not easy to deal with those of social media because they are nowhere to be found here. But otherwise, it is advisable that the government has to take some measures on how we should control the social media. And if at all it means an individual is identified practicing it, then definitely that person has to be brought to book.
Alier did not elaborate on how state authorities would go about attempting to arrest South Sudanese who post songs inciting hatred or violence on social media platforms. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng in Bor.
Several angry young people beat two UN staff, burnt offices of the World Food Programme, and destroyed vehicles belonging to UNHCR, Food and Agriculture Organization, and other international aid agencies in the Upper Nile area. The UN refugee agency UNHCR issued a statement condemning the attack on its compound in South Sudan's northwestern town of Bunj. The angry residents accused most international organizations in Maban of favoring people from certain parts of South Sudan and ignoring the sons and daughters of Maban. Jok Madu Jok is the founder of the Juba-based institute and has been monitoring the situation in the Upper Nile.
We are not happy about the issue of for the two states that is included in the peace agreement and the resolution that was met that in pre-transitional period that there would be a referendum if the boundaries are not clear. We see that the boundaries will not be clear and also the referendum could not go ahead because there will be no security in South Sudan as usual. And the time for the referendum is very short because there's a need for education to the civilian in South Sudan, There's need for good security whereby everyone can express their own voices. And there's a need also for a political environment to address such things. But in pre-transitional period, it will not be possible to make a referendum. And also the issue of the two-state was brought up when Kiir tried to breach the 2015 peace agreement in 2016. So we see that it will also be an obstacle to the peace agreement. Yet, as an IDP, we are the brave victim of this war. Therefore, we are sending our voice to the world and also to the IGAD and the mediators that the issue of the 32-state should not be in the peace deal that is signed already, that is initialized. And we see it is not important.
And how would you want this conflict to be resolved? I mean, this is an attempt to bring, if you like, peace to the country.
The politicians need to put the interests of the people first. We want to end the suffering of the people. So the solution would be this way, is to either go with 10 states that was signed in 2015 because it is said that it is revitalization of the 2015 peace deal. So in 2015, it was 10 states that were signed. And when Kiir tried to breach the peace deal, it was 32 states. Therefore, it should be only on 10 states, or either we go to the three regions that we have in January the 1st, 1956, in the time of independence. So that will be the only best solution for the South Sudanese. And if they are now clear tomorrow, they will go themselves to demand for what they want.
But why would you blame President Kiir here when the agreement that was signed by SPLM-IO, the government of South Sudan, and other stakeholders, why would you only blame the government?
Yeah, why we are blaming the government is government as a government, the prime objective of the government is the protection of civilians. And they are the one responsible to bring peace to this country because he is now in the power. We voted for him in 2010 election. He is still now in power. So he is the one to feel the pain of South Sudanese. And he is the very person who brought the issue of 32 states. And he put it forward again with his negotiation team in Khartoum that he needs the 32 states. Without 32 states, that they would not initialize the peace deal. So it was a setback on the peace. And IO, even if they signed the 32 states, we don't blame them because they did not put the proposal of 32 states forward.
But the transitional government of national unity is going to include all the signatories, including the SPLM in opposition. Why would you not hold them accountable and you're only holding the government?
Yeah, why we are holding the government accountable is, first, who put the proposal? We need to identify first what is the cause of the problem. Now, if 32 states are fine, we need to first judge who put the 32 state proposal forward and who is now compromising. Because we have seen the side of IO are compromising for the suffering of people. Even if they sign it, even if we have to blame it, it has to be a slight blame because they did not put forward the issue of 32 states. But the government themselves were the people who put that issue forward to at least keep us in suffering like what we have now. So that's why we're trying to blame them.
That was Tek Chom Nyal speaking with my colleague John Tanza with reaction to the power-sharing proposal. A constitutional court in Uganda has validated a law that removes an age limit for the country's leaders, clearing the way for long-serving President Yoweri Museveni to remain in power for life. Halima Athumani reports from Mbale.
After 11 hours of debate, 4 out of the 5 justices on Uganda's constitutional court rejected a legal challenge to a constitutional amendment that prevented anyone 75 or older from holding the presidency. Museveni, who is now 73, would have been ineligible to run again when his current term expires in 2021. Many critics opposed the lifting of the age limit, citing Museveni's 32-year rule has been punctuated by corruption scandals, human rights violations, and poor social services. Justice Kenneth Kakuru, who was on the panel, voiced his opposition to the ruling.
I find and declare that, one, the entire Constitutional Amendment Act 1 of 2018 is unconstitutional and therefore null and void. All its provisions ought to be expunged from the Constitution of Uganda.
During the amendment process, legislators voted to have their tenure extended to 7 from 5 years. But in the end, all 5 judges on the panel ruled against the move, saying it was selfish and goes against the principles of good governance. The judges noted that an extension of members of parliament's terms would only be acceptable in a state of emergency or war and even then, they would only allow a six-month extension. Winnie Kiza, the leader of opposition in parliament and one of the petitioners, says the judgment is an important lesson for legislators.
Our colleagues who thought possibly President Museveni meant well for them have now known that the law was just about himself getting his age limit and therefore ditch them along the way.
Attorney General Mwesigwa Rukutana was pleased with the outcome.
It was largely a balanced judgment, and it really painted a good picture for our rule of law. It was a win-win situation. We won in some of the issues. The petitioners also won in some of the issues.
Ugandans will now have to wait for the 2021 general elections and use their vote to hopefully bring the change they desire. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Mbale, Uganda.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Zimbabwe is preparing for a historic election on Monday. We'll have the latest details when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what stresses you out?
When I have so much to do and I end up procrastinating and leave everything the last minute, I end up being stressed out.
The economy that is really going to its end, we feel like we are finished. The economy is terrible and it's finishing me, it's stressing me.
I get stressed when I don't get my financial needs met.
Insecurity that we are facing here and there.
Too much work stresses me out, and then sometimes boredom stresses me out.
Currently, I study 9 hours in a day, and that stresses me out.
When I have a lot of work in front of me, and also there is someone need also to disturbing me, telling me something also to be added, you know, I feel more stressed.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Zimbabwe is preparing for a historic election on Monday, the first in 38 years without former leader Robert Mugabe on the ballot. But voters and observers are cautious in their optimism amid concerns over whether it will be a free and fair poll and whether the victor will actually deliver on promises to bring change. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the streets of the capital, Harare.
The 55 political parties and 22 presidential candidates in Zimbabwe's upcoming election are all peddling some version of the same thing: change. More jobs, a better economy, more or less a new dawn for a nation that for nearly four decades was ruled by one man, Robert Mugabe. But in this nation of more than 5 million voters, not everyone is convinced that change will come. 27-year-old Widnance Dick has already seen the dawn. On this morning, as on many others, she sat on the cold sidewalk, wrapped in a flimsy coat, waiting since 3 a.m. in front of a Harare bank for the one thing that every Zimbabwean, it seems, can't get enough of: hard cash. Mugabe is largely blamed for policies and poor management that left the economy in ruins and forced Zimbabwe to abandon its own currency a decade ago. Dick says she's fed up and plans to vote on Monday for opposition leader Nelson Chamisa. We want to get U.S. dollars without having to queue at the bank, she said. 8 months after President Emmerson Mnangagwa's inauguration, the economy is little improved. Mnangagwa, who took over in November after Mugabe's forced resignation, promised at his inauguration that he would take urgent action to fix the cash crisis. That hasn't happened yet. But not everyone is pessimistic. In the capital, feelings about the poll, in which Mnangagwa is the frontrunner, vary widely. 33-year-old project manager Kudzai Marongwe says he's thrilled to have a chance to vote in a poll that is freer than any in his lifetime. Election observers said Mugabe-era elections were marred by irregularities and allegations of intimidation and rigging.
Very much excited. The environment has been pretty peaceful, and the campaigning has been peaceful as well. And we've been going about our businesses normally, without fear or anything. So, yeah, it's been great.
Entrepreneur Pamela Nwube, who is 57, says she's still loyal to the ruling ZANU-PF party and has faith in them.
It's going to create many jobs for our youngsters, for our people.
But first-time voter Trifi Givondo, who is 20, says she's pessimistic. She plans to vote for Chamisa's Movement for Democratic Change.
I'm not sure there's ever going to be real change. So there's not that much excitement for the meantime. Because as far as I'm concerned, it's just the same 4 years and years. So there's not that much hope.
Observers are reserving their judgment amid accusations of voter intimidation and problems with the voter roll. But rights groups say there is reason to be hopeful. Amnesty International's Lloyd Kuvea.
Our partners on the ground have been saying that there is subtle voter intimidation, which is not as blatant as what we have witnessed before in 2008.
This is a major test for a nation that has only been led by one man since independence. Whoever wins faces an uphill battle to fix the broken economy and restore credibility to government institutions battered by inefficiency and corruption. And so, as Monday approaches, Zimbabwe holds its breath. Anita Powell, VOA News, Harare.
New data released at the 2018 AIDS conference this week in Amsterdam warns that if donor government funding for HIV continues to fall, nearly two decades of progress against the disease will be in jeopardy. A recent study from researchers at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health shows that cuts to development assistance for HIV could do serious harm. Linda Gale Becker, president of the International AIDS Society and professor of medicine and deputy director of the Desmond Tutu HIV Center at the University of Cape Town, tells VOA's Kim Lewis now is not the time for donors to pull back.
Global investments have been very important in the fight against AIDS so far, and I think we really are beginning to see some impact of that. But we are quite concerned because data would show that global donors are cutting and restricting funds, and that obviously puts that all that investment and all the progress we've made to date in grave danger. And that is one of the points we're really hoping to highlight here at Amsterdam 2018.
Why is it that funding is starting to fall off?
You know, I think there are probably multiple reasons for that. One is, you know, I think we have been quite vocal about the success we've had to date, and some of that has been translated into what I would call premature triumphalism. You know, I think sort of announcing the end of AIDS, etc., over the last few years, I think has been a strategic mistake, because I think we aren't at the end of AIDS, and in fact, the data being shown at this conference would suggest that we're off track to meet the goals that we had set for ourselves. So whilst there's been great progress, we actually need to increase our effort at the moment, and that's going to take resources rather than people saying, gosh, it looks like the problem is solved, and disengaging, which is the worst thing that could happen.
And given this, how are developing countries doing in terms of AIDS prevention and research and treatment?
There are a few things. The one is that developing countries definitely are stepping up more than ever before. So the one area where we did see an increase in funding over the last year was in in-country funding. So local funding definitely has increased. The true reality, though, is in the poorest developing countries, which is often where the greatest burden is, those countries remain very dependent on donor funding, not only for prevention, but also for their treatment needs. And the truth of the matter is that when funding starts to regress, the first thing that goes is actually prevention, simply because it's very difficult to stop treating somebody with, you know, a lifelong treatment. So governments will clearly, and health systems will do their best to keep those who need treatment going, but all our prevention efforts fall away. And so the immediate thing that happens is we lose pace on providing prevention opportunities.
How is the conference helping to shed light on this need to continue to fund for AIDS research?
Well, I think we are definitely showing the data. It's very important to see that in 50 countries, we've actually seen an increase in HIV rates. So that is the first very disturbing concept. But at the same time, we also want to have a very balanced view to show that we're making some huge progress in other regions of the world where we're starting to see a downturn in incidence. You know, I think we've got some really good news stories coming out of Eastern and Southern Africa where a few years ago the picture was very dismal indeed. So it's about getting a balanced picture out of, on the one hand, the investment is paying off and we're starting to see success. So it's not hopeless. It's not doom and gloom. On the other hand, there's still much work to be done, particularly in key populations and in certain regions of the world. And if we don't push through, then we may see a readmission of the epidemic and we may find ourselves pretty much back where we were when we started or close to. You know, I've said it before, I'll say it again, if we are not moving forward with this epidemic, then we're sliding back simply because we have infections happening and we have a treatment pool that continues to increase on a daily basis.
That's Linda Gail Becker, president of the International AIDS Society, speaking with my colleague Kim Lewis from the AIDS Conference in Amsterdam. And that's our show for this Friday. We leave you with the song Tulale Fofofo by Mikasa and Sauti Sol. Listening to Mikasa and Sauti Sol with the song Tulale Fofofo. I'm again Dang Bior in Washington. Thanks for being here. Let us know what you think about our show. You can find us at southsudan@voanews.com or reach us on Facebook. Our title is South Sudan in Focus. Enjoy your weekend and join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Shuka chini shuka, nakupenda, kama nanipenda, oya baby shuka, shuka
chini shuka kama unanipenda.